Okay, good afternoon everybody. This is always the best session, I think. Day two, straight after lunch, belly full of food, warm room, and I know you're going to be really, really interested to focus. But luckily for you, we've got a really interesting topic, which covered by the innocuous title, Developments in Banking Capital and Liquidity Requirements. Now, at first blush, that sounds really, really boring, doesn't it? But But I'm here to tell you, it's not. I spent a decade of my life working at the Bankers Association, and this topic covers one of the most important things that happened during the global financial crisis, which was the lack of liquidity. Why was it that an Australian bank with a AA plus rating couldn't borrow money for love nor money and lend to Australians? So it does cover some very, very interesting issues. It also covers the interesting issue of are banks too big to fail? I think that's one of the topics you cover as well. So I'm glad to see we have a hardcore audience here. Now, we're going to make it slightly more informal. We're not going to have presentations followed by questions. We're going to have presentations, and if you wish to, you can punctuate the presentations with questions. Our two presenters said they'll talk for about 30 minutes, so stick your hand up if you want to ask a question. I think you meant to stand behind that microphone there, but we won't bother with that formality unless you really wish to. I've also been asked to tell you that at the end, if you could please fill in a form to tell us what you thought of the particular event, and we'll take it from there. Now, in terms of formal introductions, I should have started. I'm David Bell. I'm the relatively new head of the Institute. I'm not an actuary, but I have spent a lot of time in banking, so this is something I really know and love, so I'm really looking forward to today. But more importantly, our two presenters are firstly David Sue. David is the head of capital at Westpac. His responsibilities include capital forecasting, management of the group's allocated equity framework, and delivery of market reporting, including Pillar 3. I spent 3 years at Westpac and never met David, so it's such a big organisation. We're also joined by Michelle Cater. Michelle is a division director at Macquarie. Her responsibilities include setting the methodology used by Macquarie to measure risk across the group and assess deals on a risk-adjusted basis, transaction review, stress testing, capital management and regulatory reform. I'm sure Michelle will also talk to us about why it's called the Millionaire's Factory. Maybe she's one, I don't know. Anyway, looking forward to the presentation. David, you're first, and thank you very much for your attendance today.
Okay, thanks everyone. Thanks, David, for that introduction. Thought I might just start by talking about the motivation for this paper. So there's a number of actuaries, or an increasing number of actuaries who are working in the banking sector. And you may or may not be aware, but the Banking Practice Committee has kind of reinvigorated itself with some of these actuaries who have moved into banking. And so as part of that activity, there's a number of banking-related papers at the forum, of which this is one of them. Can I just get a show of hands? Who actually is working in the banking sector in the audience? Okay. All right. So definitely an area of growing interest for actuaries. I think there's been a lot of talk about that over the last little while, and now we're starting to see that kind of build, and the Banking Practice Committee is looking to sort of support that momentum and generate more interest, because it is a big world and an interesting world for actuaries to get into. And so part of this paper is to give you, I guess, a bit of a taste of the issues that banks are thinking through and dealing to from a regulatory perspective at the moment, really just to whet your appetite to explore this world a little bit more. It's not a particularly technical paper. It is more an overview sort of presentation. So per David's comments, we're more than happy to take questions as we go through, just bearing in mind that there's probably a varying level of understanding and exposure to the banking industry in the audience. Just by way of my background, maybe a little bit further, I've been in this head of capital role for about 6 months. So I've only been in the banking sector about 6 months. I was doing traditional actuarial work as chief actuary for BT prior to this role. But this presented itself, and I thought, what a great opportunity to just learn something new and different and get my teeth into a world where I hadn't really been involved in before and apply the actuarial skills into that space. And that's been a very challenging time, but also a really interesting time for me. Definitely not, haven't mastered everything yet after 6 months, but it's been great to be able to take the skills into a new area and sort of try to earn respect without having FIAA plastered all over everything I do. So look, with that, I will... Okay, so just following some of those comments around actuarial involvement, just try to break down here the areas that the industries that actuaries are sort of involved in on the left, the pie chart on the left. And then on the right is kind of a summary of where capital is deployed in the financial services industry. And if you... It should come as no surprise that actuarial involvement is negatively correlated with where the capital is in the financial services industry. And so just to reinforce that point around, there's a big world here that as a whole, as a profession, we haven't really penetrated. And so part of the idea of this presentation today is to give you a taste of what's going on in that space. So we're going to try to cover a few things today. A little bit of history about this thing called Basel, which some of you may or may not have heard, and some of the topical issues that are happening in the regulatory space at the moment, the comparability of capital across banks, this thing called leverage ratio, some funny acronyms there which we'll talk about later, and we'll get down into liquidity if we have time. One of the things that I think we've talked about a lot as an industry, both in insurance and in banking, is regulation, and particularly since the GFC. And in my old world in insurance, I thought there was a big wave of regulation coming through and that we had to deal with. That was before I went into banking. It's a bigger wave of regulation that's happening. And one of the things that's worth just stepping back and thinking about is more better. You can sort of see the quote there. There is a lot happening in this space, and there is a role for, I think, for actuaries to contribute in thinking about how does all this stuff fit together, and is it all going to sort of make sense and make the system safer and more resilient, or are we creating things that will just have sort of unforeseen consequences down the road? So as we go through the big volume of material, I think it's worthwhile just keeping that question in mind, because that's something that the industry is sort of grappling with as more regulation comes through. Basel. Basel is a city in Switzerland, and it's also the name that's been given to essentially the global standard setter for banks. And this is sort of one of the big differences I sort of came across when I went into banking, that this, the fact that there is a sort of a global standard setter. And it's got quite a long history, as you can see on the little chart there. I won't talk through all the detail. But since the 80s or the late 80s, early 90s, this standard setting process for banks has continued to evolve. And it's evolved in response to different things that have happened within the banking industry and within the economy. So as crises have unfolded, the regulators have responded with changes, and those changes have emerged in the form of the regulations that the Basel Committee for Banking Supervision have put out over time. Probably one of the key themes if you look back and see through this is a couple of things. So first is an increasing focus on risk sensitivity, and the standard setters have tried to make that a feature of their regulation. And then more recently through the GFC, a real focus on what is capital and what's the quality of that capital that banks are reporting, and really tightening that up. So underneath that, there's a lot of history, but probably the key point to take away from this is it's generally been reactive to things that have happened and crises that have happened over the last 20 to 30 years. The most recent, of course, being the GFC, and we're still seeing some of those things playing out. So the focus of what we'll talk about today is some of the things that have been playing out, that are playing out now, and also will continue to play out over the next few years, largely as a response to what happened in the GFC. Basel III is probably what we're going to spend a fair bit of our time on. As I mentioned, a heavy focus on quality of capital and how you define that. And we've seen some of that kind of wash back through into APRA's standards for insurers as well, the LAGIC standards. Some of the regulatory buffers that have been introduced by the Basel Committee. Again, this is sort of one of the areas of difference that I saw when I came into the banking world, that the regulators set their own buffers on top of prudential minimums. And they also give themselves powers to intervene into the operations of the company if you dip into those buffers, which was a little bit different to sort of the insurance target surplus concept that that I was sort of used to. A couple of other things there. We'll talk about the leverage ratio, which is quite topical at the moment. We'll talk about the issue of risk-weighted assets. Now, I'm not sure, if I say risk-weighted assets, am I just going to get a bunch of blank stares? Some yes, some no. But I'll talk a little bit about this. Michelle will expand it on a little bit. Banks tend to have models to estimate the riskiness of the assets, which are the key source of risk in a bank. And the system for doing that and coming up with that generates what banks call risk-weighted assets. So $100 of loans to a mortgage holder, residential mortgage holder, isn't worth the same as $100 of lending to a BBB-rated corporate. And the banks and regulators give us or set how those risk weightings work. So a lot of development has happened in that space, and that's one of the key issues that we'll touch on in a minute. The other piece that Basel III has focused on is the area of liquidity. And this is sort of a risk that I had sort of not had too much exposure to in my previous actuarial roles, but it's clearly something that banks are very interested in. And part of the response to the GFC has been regulators asking banks to hold more liquidity so that they can respond adequately to crisis scenarios. These changes are still rolling through, they haven't actually come into force yet. They're coming into force very shortly, and they're still rolling through. But I think they will have quite material impacts on the way banks are thinking about their business and how they're doing business. And so we'll cover some of that off as well. Okay, I mentioned we were going to talk about comparability of bank ratios, and Michelle's going to talk about that.
Okay. Now, the half-hour estimate of the time this presentation would take was my estimate, so you'll all get an idea how good I am at estimating things if we go for longer than half an hour. So comparability of bank capital ratios. The rules for calculating the capital ratio is you take the capital supply and you divide that by the risk-weighted assets. So there are rules in the Basel framework that say this is how you calculate your capital supply, this is how you calculate your risk-weighted assets. So in theory, everyone should have the same methodology for calculating and comparable capital ratios. If we've got a 9% capital ratio and Westpac have a 10% capital ratio, you should be able to say Westpac is better capitalised than Macquarie. But actually, or probably a better example is if we've got a 9% capital ratio, JPM has a 10% capital ratio, you should say JP Morgan's better capitalised than Macquarie. But unfortunately, it's not that simple. The reason it's not that simple, you can actually have differences in both the calculation of capital supply and in risk-weighted assets. There are two sources of difference, or two broad sources of difference. One is jurisdictional differences. So in some jurisdictions, you may have a situation where a minimum set of rules that are in the Basel standards are not fully adopted. There is a little bit of that. There is probably more of a case, at least in Australia, of super equivalence. Now, what that means is There may be an asset which in the Basel framework can be a risk-weighted asset, so for example deferred tax assets, but in the APRA framework those are deductions. So what the difference between a deduction and a risk-weighted asset? A deduction is effectively an asset which is more than 100% risk-weighted. So it's the capital. You have to fund a deduction dollar for dollar. So if we make an investment into a financial institution, an equity investment to a financial institution, then if we put $100 of equity into that investment, we must fund that dollar for dollar. It's $100 of capital. So we have to just take that investment from our asset base and deduct that, and that doesn't count for your net assets calculation anymore. Super equivalence is typically a case where either there are more deductions, as is the case for certain assets in Australia. Alternatively, it could be more stricter requirements on the calculation of risk-weighted assets. So we may have to include an additional buffer in some cases in our calculation of risk-weighted assets. So that's one source of variation, is the jurisdictional source. Bank is operating within a jurisdictional adoption of Basel, so we don't have a lot of choice about those. Where we do have a little bit more choice is within our own risk models. So Macquarie has an approved advanced model for operational risk. Westpac has an approved advanced model for operational risk. Those models aren't going to be the same. So we could have exactly the same level of risk, but one bank will be holding a different level of capital from another bank. So there are variations both at the jurisdictional level and within banks. Now this slide here is mainly looking at the jurisdictional impacts. Now if any of you have decided to familiarise yourself with an annual report of a bank or a financial presentation, you will notice that all Australian banks, I think all Australian banks, disclose their APRA capital ratio, T1, CET1 total capital ratios. They will also disclose a Basel III harmonised capital ratio. And what that means is we're not applying the APRA rules for deductions and risk-weighted assets. We're applying the Basel III standard rules for capital supply and risk-weighted assets. Now, APRA is a jurisdiction that does have a number of areas of super equivalence, so you might be cynical and say that the reason that we're all disclosing the Basel III harmonised is because it's actually a higher ratio. But less cynically, what you would infer from this is that investors do, when they're purchasing debt or they're making investments, they do want to be able to understand, to be able to compare banks on a like-for-like basis. Now, controlling for the jurisdictional differences in calculations gives people a better foundation for being able to compare banks. So this is just an example of the adjustment that one bank is doing to go from the APRA CET1 ratio, or their APRA CET1 ratio of around 8.3%, adding back in deductions for things like deferred tax assets, capitalised expenses, etc., and then arriving at a Basel III ratio. So what investors should be looking at is comparing that Basel III ratio to other European and US banks. Now that still doesn't control for everything, bear in mind, because there are areas of phasing in of certain rules. So the US banks, for example, will be calculating their Basel III ratio with some elements of a Basel I framework, because they were on Basel I, they never went to Basel II. They're on their way to being to Basel III, but they're not quite there yet. So they will disclose a Basel ratio with transitional arrangements. So it still does make the comparison very difficult, but we're trying to make it a little bit easier. Now, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision does want and did intend for capital ratios to be comparable. They have done some studies to try and identify how comparable things are, and they found that there are some differences. There are, as I said, those jurisdictional differences, but also differences in the models that people are using. So this is a key area of what's quoted by Steinberg, who's the chairman of the committee, as being one of the most important tasks for the Basel Committee going forward, is how to address this comparability issue. They're doing this in a number of ways, one of which I think is probably more of interest to actuaries than the others, and that is the policy response. So the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision is, as they're bringing out rules, they're looking at various things like creating flaws or minimising the degrees of freedom that we have around the modelling that we're doing. So one example is in our trading book calculations. Historically, banks have been able to select their own time period for calibrating those models, but under new proposed rules, they're looking at standardising those periods. So there's multiple sources of variation. It's difficult to see how you get rid of all of them without actually rolling out a standardised model, but there are ways to address them on the fringes. In terms of rolling out a standardised model, that is something that they are also looking at doing. So there's too much variation in advanced models. Let's roll out a standardised model that everybody needs to use. The one personal comment that I would make about that is it's a form of spurious accuracy. If you give everybody a standardised model, then the impact of that standardised formula on Macquarie's portfolio will be different to Westpac's portfolio. So you have the same calculation methodology, but you don't have like-for-like answers. By the accounting auditors? Yeah, we do. The APS 310 standard does require, it might be 330 actually, is the auditor's sort of overview of our sort of framework, our capital management framework. The advanced models, though, I would say are more audited, probably not so much audited, but there are regular visits with APRA to explain the modelling results. They're also subject to internal audit. We do, we internally in our business, and I think it probably is a requirement to have an internal quantitative group that audits all of the models. So there's various layers of audit of those models. We'd like to do whatever we want, but we can't.
Well, it is quite interesting. I think Michelle's right. So capital ratios are actually the only negative assurance. There's no positive audit assurance on bank capital ratios. So I was quite surprised to find that 6 months ago. Yeah.
The leverage ratio is another policy response, which I'll come to on the next slide. It's probably one of the key tools that the regulators are using and the Basel Committee are using to try and effectively control for the impacts of different models. So I'll come to that briefly. Supervisory implementation. There are regulatory consistency assessment program assessments, and that is what the Basel is doing. Effectively, that's Basel looking at APRA's compliance with the Basel framework. So what rules they've put in place, how what the impact of that is, etc. They're looking to eliminate national discretions. There are a number of areas in the Basel framework that allows national discretions, and those they're looking to eliminate those. And then disclosure. So maybe we're all calculating it differently, but if we give the investors enough information, then if they want to calculate it a different way, they can do that. So that's the purpose of the additional disclosure. I'm not suggesting it would be removed. If it is a national discretion, it could be removed. But I think APRA would push back very, very hard on that. So it is just an area that I'm flagging that Basel is looking at. But there will be inevitably, I think, some differences. And they're not talking about removing all super equivalents, just various items of national discretion.
Yeah. I think this is an area of disclosure. So APRA in the end can do what they want. Basel can say that doesn't line up. But APRA can still say, I mean, APRA have been very open about this, that they have said we are implementing Basel in a conservative way. So I think that where this will get dealt to is in disclosure, which is back to Michelle's point around at least all the major banks published an estimate of what their capital ratios would be if you just applied the pure sort of Basel rules.
Yeah, and one example of disclosure is with this leverage ratio. So the leverage ratio is one of these examples of basically being a flaw. So it's a simplified calculation compared to the normal capital calculation. Simply, it is the sort of capital. It's tier one capital divided by total exposure. Now there is some complexity in that total exposure calculation. It isn't just the total sort of assets all on the balance sheet. The reason there has to be some complexity in that is because banks have a lot of off-balance sheet exposures, so committed facilities, derivatives, etc., that does actually require some sort of credit conversion factors to be able to accurately calculate that. So there has been some work done on the leverage ratio since it was first announced. Originally, for example, they weren't allowing any offsets for secure financing transactions, so repo-like transactions. You weren't able to offset exactly matching assets and liabilities. Now you can. So there's been a lot of work in the leverage ratio, and the exposure is a little bit more complicated, I think, than had first been intended, but they've landed on something that they think is reasonable. The minimum leverage ratio that was originally proposed and currently stands is 3%. The US banks have made that a 5% for the 8 biggest SIFI banks. So that is quite a high leverage ratio. Now, the 3% isn't at the moment, I think, set in stone. So now that the Basel Committee have decided on their measure of exposure, they are intending to come back and revisit this 3%. Now, why they might change that, it's an issue of calibration. They have stated that they don't want the leverage ratio to be the binding constraint for all banks. It may be and can act as the binding constraint for some banks, but it isn't intended to be the binding constraint for most banks. It is a simplistic measure. You don't necessarily want a simplistic measure which isn't risk-sensitive being a binding constraint. So it makes sense that they don't want it to be the binding constraint. So I'm just flagging it's possible that that 3% might change, but that's what it is currently. So this is really that, you know, let's not get into the detail of risk-weighted assets and models and all that thing. Let's just do a really simple calculation and measure the amount of leverage you have. Compared to, you know, banks are very leveraged, so you can see why people just want to get sort of a simple view on how much leverage are in the financial institutions. One interesting thing about the leverage ratio that I'll just mention before we move on is it has been sort of argued that it encourages risk-taking. So a bank that does more risky trades of loans might have the majority of its balance sheet with a 10% capital ratio. Another bank which has most of its capital invested in, say, government bonds would have an average capital ratio of 2%. The leverage ratio could become binding for that sort of less risky bank, whereas it wouldn't be binding for the more risky bank. So that has been one sort of criticism of the leverage ratio. But the response to that from the Basel Committee has really been, look, it's not intended to be the binding constraint, and they're not, I think it is, for them it's an issue of calibration. And I'll hand back over to David.
Through the GFC, no doubt all of you will have heard of the issues around public sector support for banks, and in response to that, regulators have said, and governments have indeed have said, we do not want public sectors propping up the banking sector anymore. What can we change? One of the responses has been to implement what they've called a systemically important bank framework, and in that framework, identifying which organisations are systemically important and therefore would be subject to additional requirements, be that capital, regulation, or I'll call it structuring, in terms of how would you resolve, wind up one of these major institutions if they did get into trouble. There are 29 banks in the world who have been designated as global systemically important banks. There's a similar framework for insurers, which I'm not as close to, but there are 9 globally systemic important insurers, and none of the Australian banks are GSIB, so global systemically important banks. However, The Basel framework also allowed for the establishment of a domestic, systemically important bank framework, and APRA has absolutely taken that on board and established a framework around that. And I think this is worth talking a little bit about, because it's one area where I've found it quite interesting thinking through some of the parallels with the insurance world. So the way this works is APRA have identified four banks as D-SIBs, and what they've said is those four banks need to hold more capital expressed in the form of minimum capital ratios than non-D-SIB banks. They call that a higher loss absorbency requirement, and that computes to 1% of the risk-weighted assets of a bank. So that's an extra 1%. The diagram on the right kind of sets out how the regulatory framework operates at a high level. The regulator sets a minimum capital CET1 capital ratio of 4.5, and then there's this thing called the capital conservation buffer. And what that buffer is or says is if your capital ratios start moving into that buffer, then the regulator can start imposing restrictions on distributions from the bank. And that's obviously predominantly going to impact the dividend capacity of a bank. For market-facing banks, that's a key issue. And so the D-SIB just says that capital conservation buffer is bigger. But from a market perspective, the market will look at that and go, I really expect banks to sit at least at 4.5 plus 3.5, which is 8%. And I'll think about whether you're well capitalised if you're above that level. The CCB, I think, had some interesting challenges and parallels from an ICAP perspective for a bank, and thinking about how do I calibrate my own internal buffers above that, taking into account the consequences of moving into the CCB. So it's a serious thing. Or banks take it seriously if they can't keep their dividend flow up. So in thinking about the bank's ICAP document, how do I calibrate my buffers, think about what I would do in those situations where I start dipping into the CCB is quite a live topic at the moment. And probably has been heightened because of APRA's imposition of the D-SIB loading for, at least for the four major banks. The other point is that these requirements formally start from 1 January 16, with no phase-in. The Basel minimum says they start from 1 January 16, but with a phase-in period. So you will see a lot of the major banks globally perhaps taking advantage of that longer transition period. Again, in practice, the market goes, this is coming. If I'm going to look at you and think about your level of capitalisation, I'm going to think about whether you are well capitalised relative to what is coming. And so the major banks in Australia, I think you will find generally already have capital ratios sitting at or above that 8% level. But as I said, from an actuarial viewpoint, that sort of capital management issue of thinking about how do I calibrate the buffers of my own internal buffers above those regulatory floors, and think about what do I do when I start dipping in, and how much appetite do I have for cutting back my dividend, has been that's quite a live issue at the moment. Yep.
So what are your thoughts?
I think globally, that's probably more possible. So the guidelines do say here are kind of the thresholds and parameters that we will use to assess whether you are a systemically important organisation or not. So there probably is some risk of that globally. I'd say in Australia, not too much, because the practicalities of how the APRA have calibrated the requirements are, you've got the four major banks up here, and then there's sort of daylight down to the next couple of regionals and Macquarie and Suncorp and the rest. So I'd say not so much danger in Australia, possibly more globally.
Just one comment I would make on that, though. It's not all downside being declared a D-SIB or a G-SIB, right? Because you do or would expect to get some kind of funding and rating benefit So there's a trade-off. It's not something that you want to avoid at all costs. So it's not, yeah, we want to get there and not go over the line. Actually, if you're already there, you maybe do want to go over the line.
Yeah, and that's a very live topic at the moment through the FSI, or the Financial Services Inquiry. And it plays into issues about competition and relative competitive advantage for the majors versus other banks in the market, and probably a topic that's too big for today. Okay. I'll just touch briefly on this. The other aspect of or response to systemically important banks has been how to wind them up or resolve them if they get into trouble. And probably the point here is this is an emerging area. I'd say for the Australian banks, not so much of an issue, but if you're a big international bank, these developments, I think, will have implications for how you structure yourself, how you organise yourself. One of the big topics will be, or is, the concept of bail-in, and that is that during the crisis, if you were a debt investor in one of these failing banks, you were effectively bailed out because the government supported, or the public sector supported the bank. The concept of bailing in debt investors into banks is absolutely an emerging area, and it's probably the one where this whole issue around resolution will most impact banks locally, I think, because credit agencies will think about how much government support do I factor into your credit rating a lot harder, or are thinking about it a lot harder now than what they were a couple of years ago. So from a credit rating perspective and therefore cost of funding perspective, That's an area where I think this will have a much more immediate impact to local banks. I think it also does kind of raise up the bigger question around how do regulators trade off these different things. So I ask these big banks to hold more capital. I say you've got to make yourself easier to wind up. What's the right answer to this question about too big to fail? And it's not all just more capital, and it's not all just restructuring yourself. There's sort of a balance between these two issues, and that discussion and topic is still playing out as these requirements start to continue to emerge from Basel. Conscious of time, do you want to skip level 3 and go to liquidity?
So yeah, we'll just jump ahead to some of the liquidity reforms, which are quite interesting. Obviously, liquidity was a big issue in the sort of crisis. So a couple of the requirements that the Basel Committee have introduced, there's two. There's a liquidity coverage ratio and a net stable funding ratio. They do attempt to hit on slightly different things. The liquidity coverage ratio is more of a 30-day measure. So if there is a sort of quick instantaneous liquidity crisis, do banks have enough inflows or liquid assets to cover the net outflows? And then net stable funding ratio is a sort of a longer term, looking to make sure that term assets can match, or term liabilities can match term assets. Really quickly, since I haven't got very long, the liquidity coverage ratio has been a big issue for Australia. There is a requirement, quite basically, it's the stock of high quality liquid assets divided by net cash outflows. The big issue with this for Australia has been that Australia doesn't have an adequate pool of assets which meet the definition that Basel has set to meet that 100% ratio. So high quality assets, quite simply, are there's a description of them here, but they are assets that have a liquidity generating capacity which is expected to remain stable. So if you think of it in that context, you can usually think about equities covered, Probably not, because you wouldn't expect the price to remain stable. Government bonds, yes, very liquid, price would remain stable. So that'll give you a feel for what they're thinking of when they're talking about high-quality liquid assets. Now, Australia, if you read any of the Reserve Bank and APRA announcements on this, Australia doesn't really have the amount of government debt to meet the bank's requirements of a shortfall under the liquidity coverage ratio requirements. So the Reserve Bank has provided a committed liquidity facility in place of that. Now, that's probably a good thing for Australia. If you think about some of those other markets, one of the criticisms of the liquidity coverage ratio is that it means that a lot of these government bonds are going to be stored up, or US Treasuries stored up, in a lot of the banks, and then if a crisis does hit, everyone's going to be selling the same thing at the same time. So having a committed liquidity facility is probably not a bad thing. I think I probably need to stop there.
So we've got about 2 or 3 minutes before we wind up. Are there any particular questions people would like to ask? I might sort of exercise my chair's privilege and talk about a couple of the paradoxes that have come out of this. You know, cutting to layman's language, it does seem to me that there's a paradox in that the act of making banks hold more liquidity or have more liquidity reduces liquidity in the market. Is that too simplistic a reaction, or is that a reality?
I'd say that probably is a reality. It's certainly one of the areas of discussion around the liquidity coverage ratio has been the impact on the Treasury market. There's also other impacts, of combined impacts of the liquidity changes, but also the leverage ratio and what that means for repo markets. Repo are very low capital markets, and the net stable funding ratio and leverage ratios really are going to have a potentially material impact on repo markets, which generally takes liquidity out of the system. So not all the flow on of all of this may not be what was intended necessarily.
That's terrific. So we're facing another GFC, is that what you're saying? No, we're not. Look, that comes to the end of it. So welcome to the wild world of banking and acronyms. It's been fantastic for me. I've been able to re-engage in the things that really interest me. Seriously, it has been a very interesting session. Thank you for your attendance. It is a very detailed and interesting topic, so if you want to ask more questions, I'm sure that David and Michelle will be more than happy to help you. So be rest assured I'll be giving them a gift of wine, and I'm sure they'll enjoy that this afternoon. If you could please join me in thanking David and Michelle.